Hello, everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray. And on this week's show, we have two feature interviews. We'll be talking with Chris Weissopel, the CTO and co-founder of Vericode, about using static analysis techniques to find backdoors in software. With Juniper, AMX, Fortinet, and Cisco all experiencing either maliciously planted or accidental backdoors, this is a hot topic. Chris joins us to talk about how you find this stuff and whether or not vendors are actually looking into this issue appropriately. We're also checking in this week with Martin Ruten, editor of Virus Bulletin. We're having a quick chat to him about how the AV industry is reacting to Tavis Ormandy's latest research into the security of its product. He's been reporting bugs in all sorts of AV products lately, and apparently the disclosures are having an impact on that industry. In this week's sponsor interview, we're checking in with Haroon Mir of Thinkst Applied Research. They have released some free tools that generate and track honey tokens. These are old ideas made easy and workable, and he'll be along to explain the new tech. But yeah, I personally think this stuff is great. It's just great. And of course, he'll plug his even more awesome commercial stuff, Canary Tools. All of that is coming up later. But first up, as always, it's time for a check of the week's security news headlines with our good pal, Adam Boileau. And Adam, in our first news item of the week, Israel's power grid got hacked. No, it didn't. Yes, it did. What the hell is going on?
Yeah, there's been a lot of reports, of course, following up with the the hacking of the power grid in the Ukraine, which the power grid actually did get hacked. We talked about last week, I think it was the week before. There has been widespread reports that the Israeli power grid was hacked. It turned out that actually what appears to have happened is that the Israeli electricity authority, which is a small bureaucratic function that looks after the power industry marketplace in Israel, about 30 people apparently, got ransomware through phishing, just like everybody else ever, and somehow that got spun into, oh my God, power hacking.
Which
it really does not appear to be what has happened.
No, but it's not fair because we all like those sort of stories and then they turn out not to be true and it's like, oh God, why couldn't it have been the jihadis, because then everyone can go berserk. Jihadis hack Israel. Come on, what better headline us, right?
Exactly. That's where everything was segueing towards and then it's just, they're just toying with us.
We're relevant. We're relevant on the global stage. Anyway, it was not to be. Unfortunately, it was not to be. Krebs on Security reports that Wendy's, what are they, like a burger chain?
Yeah,
Wendy's, the iconic brand Wendy's, has been hacked.
Wendy got hacked, yes. Apparently there's some sort of card breach that is across a large swathe of the Wendy's stores in the US. Unclear whether it's spread to any of the other or is affecting any of the other franchises around the world. The numbers seem to suggest that at least part of the US Wendy's fleet has been owned and cards are being skimmed and they're investigating. It looks like it's gone back to at least sometime last year. I'm sure the usual people are rolling the usual sort of instant response. Hopefully they didn't hire a trust wave, otherwise there'd be another lawsuit underway. Or is it too soon for that joke? After last week.
No, never too soon. We should make it a weekly thing. We don't have a whipping boy anymore. It used to be CA, and CA are just so far from being relevant these days that even making jokes about them, it's just not funny anymore.
Well, exactly. It makes us seem unrelevant because CA hasn't actually released a product in the last decade.
So I think it's going to have to be Trustwave. We can have a weekly who's suing Trustwave segment. Maybe these guys, we don't know who the auditor is yet. God, we'll laugh our ass off if it turns out that it was Trustwave, and we'll probably die of laughter if they wind up suing. Oh, now this week in backdoors, the federal government in the United States is actually going to do an audit to find out if they've got any backdoor Juniper firewalls. I mean, that's going to be a big process in and of itself. I'd imagine there would be in certain networks, they're going to have to do a bit of work to figure out what could have maybe been exposed. Correlate that against other information about known ops, things like that. But what a disaster.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. I mean, even just the practical aspects of doing this, trying to figure out, what files you got, what versions they ran, when they were upgraded, who used them, what the impact would be, all that kind of thing is a massive amount of work.
What sort of data travelled across those links and were there any suspicious BGP announcements at that time, that sort of thing?
I mean, all of the technical aspects of this are really complicated. And then there's the kind of higher level, ironic bits of, the US House of Representatives Committee on Oversight and Government Reform asking federal government agencies to go and investigate whether they were using a backdoor that was probably designed originally by the NSA in their networks. irony much.
I can hear your mind is boggling. meanwhile, Fortinet, you know, we briefly mentioned this, I think, last week, but there is like an SSH hard-coded cred pair in Fortinet devices, which is, you know, of course, for customer maintenance and all of that good stuff. That's popping up in all sorts of Fortinet products, which is embarrassing for them. And of course, this other stuff made by AMX, this AMX like video conferencing and communications gear also has a hard-coded backdoor that is being, you know, used for customer maintenance and all those sorts of good things as well. You know, used by all sorts of people like the US Army, the White House, you know, it's just like, can we just stop it with the hard-coded creds, you know?
I went to a meeting this very morning to talk about very serious business things. And yeah, AMX control panel in the meeting room.
Oh, and also in a Lenovo file sharing app, which I mean, I think if you're using a Lenovo file sharing app at all, you've probably got some issues there anyway.
Yeah, right? I mean, if you're using any software at all designed by or implemented by Lenovo, you're going to have a bad time.
Like, you're going to have
just
a bad
time. Stick to making laptops with decent keyboards and get the out of everything else, please, Lenovo.
Indeed. Now, the Crypto Wars, you know, version 2.0, just, you know, I mean, God, I just can't even believe that we are sitting here in 2016 having this conversation. But anyway, we're looking at two state bills popping up in the United States, one in New York, one in California, which are the sort of jurisdictions us outside of the United States sort of associate with being, like, not as bonkers as the other jurisdictions. They're proposing bills to, you know, ban crypto and stuff because human trafficking. Of course, Adam.
Of course, because human trafficking. And that's the one in California as well, isn't it? The human trafficking one. So they're
it's
saying
it's a den of human trafficking. I mean, I had no idea that California was, you know, awash with trafficked humans, but there you go.
And apparently all of the important information relating to those trafficked humans is on, you know, iOS devices that are fully patched.
Yeah, exactly,
and secured,
right?
As opposed to, you know, rubbish burner Androids or Nokia phones or anything else. Of course, the legislation is not based in anything, or proposed, you know, things are not based in anything like actual fact, either in terms of how you would implement them or the actual need for these. I mean, there's no examples being given, as far as I've seen in any of the reports, of, you know, cases where they have failed to prosecute human tracking specifically because of crypto. There's plenty of examples of places where they have succeeded because of information they found on phones, but there's no evidence that, you know, the opposite proves true. But either way, surely, and as you say, especially in jurisdictions like, you know, the New York and California, these would never actually make it anywhere. But I guess if it starts there, we're going to see the same thing crop up elsewhere. And, you know, proposing that manufacturers be able to decrypt their things, you're just not going to win this one. Like, maths is not on your side, let alone everything else.
Well, and we were just talking about all of these horrible risks due to hard-coded, you know,
well,
means
exactly.
of access. So, yeah, you know.
Can't. Yeah, I mean, and you could not get a better contrast than, you know, the federal government asking, you know, you to investigate exactly the very backdoors that you're now attempting to introduce through legislature somewhere else. Like, you couldn't make it more clear. And, you know, Americans love a black and white story with a good guy and a bad guy. But when there's two bad guys, I don't know what they're going to do.
Yeah.
Shoot them both, I suppose. That's the
27B/6 for those who've seen Brazil. This is very, you know, it's a funny old world, we might say. Moving on, and Ars Technica has reposted a blog post by an Australian bloke named Eric Springer about his fantastic experience with Amazon customer service.
Yeah, this is a really good read, and I'm sure all of the listeners should go and have a look at this particular story. But it charts his interaction with Amazon, where he used to work, apparently, where his accounts were being, you know, used to carry out fraud by talking to the customer services people and kind of phishing them for information about him, such as his you know, address and credit card details and that kind of thing. Like one of the example conversations, because he managed to get some of the chat logs, because this was text-based chat with Amazon customer support. He managed to get some of the chat logs out of them to illustrate what they were doing. And so they used, for example, fake address out of one of his domain Whois records to then kind of get the real shipping address of the most recent thing he'd shipped from Amazon to get his real address and then go and use that to go and get credit cards at his name, that kind of thing. But it's a really good example of, you know, real world threats, you know, that can be carried out using services like Amazon or other online stuff to get information. Although reading this particular story, and it's a good, you know, I guess the temptation is to say, well, you know, Amazon should do a better job of not, you know, having their customer services people give out information. But I mean, the real takeaway that I thought from this was the fact that you can get something useful in life out of knowing someone's name and address you know, in terms of being able to defraud them. Like, that's the root cause problem here, not necessarily Amazon or anyone else's.
Well, and there was the
phone companies.
There was the whole Matt Honan Apple reset thing that happened, and Amazon was a part of that as well. Like, you know, between different help desks having different procedures, you can sort of cobble together little bits of information. But I got to say, you know, my experience with Amazon, a while ago I had to disable 2FA for my AWS account because this podcast is hosted on S3, right? It was way too easy. I just rang them up and said, can you disable 2FA? And they're like, yeah, sure. What's your email address? I'm just like, what? But we've got to realize too that this news comes to us in the same week that Apple were being pilloried for not handing over access to an account to the wife of someone who died, you know, like they had a terrible time getting access to that account. And of course, they were written up as being bastards. And meanwhile, if they give too much access to your account, they're also written up as bastards. So it's a difficult balance, that one.
Yeah, no, it really is. And certainly, I mean, the example of Amazon 2FA, I believe that has changed a bit since the, like, I guess it was moving a couple of years ago you did that.
Yeah.
The last stories I've heard is Amazon are much tighter at that now.
Oh, good, because it was Hilarabad. Man, I could not believe it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think the last story I heard involved Amazon requiring a document signed by a court clerk to say that you were where you are and to get it disabled and that kind of thing. So, you know, a little bit improved. But as you said, there's really no good option for these organizations and the interaction between the organizations. I mean, you know, a lot of this stuff is tied to your phone number, and then social engineering the phone company to either get your number ported or to redirect or that kind of thing is the weak point for a lot of these things.
Well,
that, you know, phone off. But yeah, it's just such a complicated ecosystem, and everybody is, you know, is kind of screwed in some way by this.
Yeah, well, I have an account with one of the major banks here in Australia, and last time I used their app, there was a little pop-up warning me that if my phone stopped working, I should give them a call. So I think there's some people in Australia who've discovered the joys of SIM swap fraud. So that's kind of new. We haven't really seen a lot of that here. But you know that when a major bank, you know, we've got four banks here controlling something like 85% of retail banking. You know when one of those guys is sending push alerts to its app users saying, you know, that's kind of interesting, right? Shodan has done it again. Some real funny stuff happening with Shodan. They've indexed a whole bunch of like baby monitors and CCTV cameras, but some of what's turning up on them is hilarious. My personal favorite is, you know, grow houses for like hydroponic weed. People have like put security cameras on them and they're open on the internet. Oh my God. That's just too funny.
It looks like Shodan added support for scanning for RTSP, the real-time streaming protocol, which is port 504. And has been, you know, taking screenshots of all the cameras that goes past. And yes, as you expect, there is one of everything. Ours is very classily running a picture of a guy sitting on his crapper, taken nice. From his webcam.
Because I know that is really where I need to be surveilled. Do you know what I mean? Because
we got to think of the children, Patrick, or the human traffickers, or the
exactly.
Else,
it's the human traffickers, terrorists. But that's fun. So you can go to Shodan now and see people having a poo and growing weed and all sorts of things. So that's maybe something for your lunch break. There you go. Andy Greenberg, who is a crypto coin fancier, has a write up here of Zcash or Zcash for our American listeners, for our American friends. This is a untraceable Bitcoin, as they say, sort of like Zerocoin. I'm guessing, which was sort of cobbled together by the likes of Matthew Green and those types, you know, people who actually know about encryption. So these are like Bitcoin, but untraceable.
Yeah, well, obviously having, you know, Bitcoin's value is in the distributed blockchain and be able to validate transactions. But having a global ledger of transactions does come with its own challenges. So we've seen a number of people, you know, look for ways to try and, you know, remove that. And there's some technical mechanisms in of tumbling and that kind of thing. But yeah, actually having some kind of cryptocurrency that is actually designed from the beginning for this is important. But because I mean, a lot of Bitcoin, you know, aficionados really don't understand the threat models or the, you know, the problems that Bitcoin set up to solve and the fact that anonymity is not actually one of them.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Well, it's all been pretty funny though, watching people talk about the threats to to Bitcoin being the, you know, unsustainable growth of the blockchain, blah blah blah. And I would have thought a bigger threat to it was the fact that everybody with, you know, more than a few coins has a giant target painted on their back, and we've basically turned money into ones and zeros that can be stolen from your computer, and that is fundamentally a terrible idea. But anyway.
But anyway, I know a little bit later on we're going to talk about some of the vulnerabilities in the UPnP libraries, Universal Plug and Play, of which includes the Bitcoin. Like the official Bitcoin client has Universal Plug and Play, and you can just kind of own it and steal people's Bitcoins. Yeah, obviously making money that stealable
now,
on the internet is not a super desirable
now thing. That, my friend, is a worm worth writing. Now, also, I just want to update listeners also on this Craig S. Wright, this Australian guy who is, Wired and Ars and a few others, you know, sort of claimed was Satoshi Nakamoto. Apparently the Australian Taxation Office has stepped up its investigation into Craig S. Wright. They're questioning former business associates. They're using a, I think they got a fraud team out of Brisbane looking into it. This is, of course, been reported. This has, of course, been reported by Leo Shanahan for the Australian newspaper. Unfortunately, that story is behind a paywall, but I've included a link to a write-up of his write-up in this week's show notes, so you can go check that out. Another one from Krebs on security here. A firm is suing their cyber insurer over a $480,000 loss that they won't cover. I mean, these sort of stories pop up every now and then. Usually you see a customer suing a bank over a dodgy transaction. These guys are actually suing their insurer for not paying out on their claim.
Yeah, so this company, Meriforge Group, had insurance through Federal Insurance, a division of Chubb, Chubb Group. And yeah, the CEO, CEO's email was impersonated through the CFO. CFO got instructed to wire $480,000 to an account in China. He did so because, you know, why wouldn't you just wire $500,000 to China without asking anybody, especially when the email in question told him not to ask anybody because, you know, SEC something, something, mumble, mumble. They went to their insurer, tried to get it covered. The insurer said that an email instructing a financial transaction is not a financial instrument covered by their policy and to basically suck at fishies and birdies. And they've, you know, gone onwards and sued their insurer. But yeah, this is certainly, as you say, not the first time we've heard a story, you know, where, you know, just being, you know, having an email telling you to transfer money doesn't really count as hacking. It doesn't really count as a, you know, the sort of financial transfer that's covered by your insurance. I think anyone who's relying on their insurance to cover this kind of thing, probably should go and check the fine print of their policy. But of course, all of the insurers are going to try and weasel for as long as possible until they either get nailed down or they figure out some way to actually kind of, you know, make the premiums cover the massive amount of money being lost. And that was a thing that I was most surprised about, is that the numbers here are like
mind-boggling.
$750 million between October 2013 and August 2015 is what the FBI is saying.
Yeah, just by sending emails saying, please send money, K, thanks, bye.
Exactly. Why is anyone bothering with botnets and all this hard work when you could just send an email saying, hey, would you mind terribly sending me a whole bunch of money?
I don't know why I bother with this podcast in light of this. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's a good little scam, that one.
Yeah.
Moving on to some malware news now, and ThreatPost reports on this Scarlet Mimic Group. This is behind a four-year campaign against Tibetan and Uyghur activists. Gee, I wonder who could be behind that one.
I wonder. Yeah. No, there's you know, a bunch more research being done on the, you know, the mechanics of this particular group and some of their operating techniques, which yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, classic state-sponsored espionage. And as you say, like, gee, I wonder who could be behind it.
Apple has released patches for iOS, OS 10, and Safari, so Apple users can go get them. OpenSSL has patched two vulnerabilities this week. Anything serious?
We haven't actually seen the details, I believe, of the of there's two bugs being patched. One is a low, they're describing it as low severity, affecting all releases of OpenSSL. And I mean, I don't think that's anything particularly unusual. We're kind of used to those. The second one they're describing as high, but affecting a particular point release, so 1.0.2, which, given how slow and, you know, glacial the OpenSSL patching process is in most places, and because of the way it's embedded and compiled into things, you know, newer versions of OpenSSL don't get deployed particularly fast. So yeah, it may not turn out to be a big one. But we will see, I guess, when they actually do release the details, whether it is a planet melter or whether it's just your common garden, you know, everyday bug.
Magento has patched 20 vulnerabilities in its, you know, online store software. So there's a whole bunch of CSRFs and XSSs and all of that good stuff. So if you are running a Magento store, you're responsible for a Magento store. That is one that you certainly need to be across. Wired has a fun little piece here about a nice little way to crash Safari on iOS that people have just been sort of screwing with each other, you know, with. So they've been emailing it around and sending it on Twitter saying, hey, guys, check this out. And it makes iPhones reboot. I mean, it's kind of shitty that, you know, this sort of DOS idiocy works, right?
Yeah, I mean, I gather actually this is a, I believe it's not just on iOS.
It's a Chrome bunch of browsers, as well, right?
A whole bunch of browsers across a bunch of platforms, been Chrome or Windows. It appears to be a like a recursive loop that sticks sites into the recently visited sites list in your browser URL bar, and it just kind of exhausts that, and then it crashes trying to render it, and that's the end of that. Which is not necessarily the sort of thing that's going to get you owned, but it's super inconvenient if you're in the middle of using a browser for something important. Which, given that everything is a web app, you probably are. But yes, if you'd like to do that or have fun with your friends, crashsafari.com.
There you go.
What you're looking for.
Well, it's a good description, isn't it? They're all about clarity, those guys. Clarity and meaning. Finally, Adam, an iOS cookie theft bug has been patched, apparently after, 2.5 years after the report first went to Apple. So well done, despite the tardiness, people at Apple, at Cupertino. And also Oracle has again pushed some patches, because that seems to be, what do Oracle do? Oh, they're that company that makes security patches. That's basically what they do.
If only they could just skip the step of writing the horrible vulnerable code they have to write patch to, and just ship security patches, that'd be nice.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty much what they do now. So,
yet more Java bugs.
Yeah. Fun times. All right, Adam, that's actually it for the week's news. Thank you very much for joining us, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Cheers, Pat. Talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's news headlines. Next up, we're chatting with Vericode co-founder and CTO Chris Weiss-Sopel. Vericode, of course, offers code scanning and static analysis of software source code and binaries. They scan your software and look for mistakes, but they can also look for backdoors. In light of just how many products out there are turning up with hard-coded creds in them and other types of backdoors, I thought it would be a good idea to speak to Chris about how you can detect these sorts of things through static analysis. Hard-coded creds aren't actually that hard to spot, he says, and many vendors are starting to turn to services like Vericodes to check their software for these types of mistakes, shall we say. That's the polite way of saying it. Mistakes. Nothing involving the F word. He joined me via Skype for this interview.
Really, the only way to spot backdoors is to inspect the source or inspect the binary. You have to inspect the code. You can't find a backdoor by fuzzing or using a program or throwing inputs at a program or looking at you have to actually inspect the functionality at the code level to find it. So looking at source code is great if you have source code. If you only have binaries, you can still inspect binaries. One thing that we've seen by doing, I've done some research on backdoors, both applications and appliances. And essentially, if a backdoor is in open source, where the source is available, it's typically found in days or weeks from when it was inserted. And if the backdoor is in an appliance that's closed source or a program that's a closed source binary, it typically takes years to find them, because it just makes it that much harder.
So how do you measure that? When it comes to the open source stuff, you've got actual specific examples here where you can say, well, it was introduced and then found after a short time sort of thing.
Yeah. So, this isn't a new topic, right? I did a Black Hat presentation with Chris Eng back in 2007. And we did some research at that time and went back about 10 years and looked for all the different backdoors we could find. And all the open source backdoors we could find, it was really on the order of days or weeks between when it was detected, when they could go look in hindsight when it was detected and when it was discovered. So if the source is published, it's typically pretty hard to keep it a secret. But on the binary side, one of the great examples that we used was Borland had this program called Interbase that they had from they wrote it in the early 90s. And, Borland got out of the database business. And in 2001, they decided to open source it. Within a few weeks of them open sourcing it and people looking at the code, they were able to find that there was a backdoor in this database that gave anyone admin access to the Borland Interbase database if you knew the backdoor was there. So it had gone 7 years and no one found it. They open sourced it. It was found right away. So inspecting the code is really the only way and the best way to do that. Now, binary analysis has improved over time. Vericode, we went to market with binary analysis in 2007, and we've kept improving it. And we do have specific checks in there to look for both you know, the classic backdoor of a, you know, a authentication bypass.
A hard-coded password, the classic.
Yeah, the classic stuff. Or we look for what we call backdoor indicators, which are things like obfuscation. Like, why is someone reading a static string and then sending it through, you know, UUID code or something like that? That doesn't make any sense. So they're just trying to hide something from someone who's inspecting the binary or the source code. So we look for the also backdoor indicators, which indicate someone's trying to hide the functionality of the program from someone who's doing inspection. And that really points you to, we need to do a deep inspection here, because there's a reason they're doing that.
So how many times do you get customers actually submitting third-party binaries to you to scan for this sort of stuff? Can they do that, or would that be a violation of the terms of the vendor? So say I'm a Juniper customer. Can I dump their binaries and then send them to you for scanning?
We don't allow that just because of licensing issues. We don't want Juniper or Cisco suing us as a small company, right? So what we do is we make sure that there's the permission of the IP owner all the time. Now, we do this a lot, but typically it's with the permission. So like say a big bank is really concerned about a backdoor somewhere, they'll get the vendor to allow us to inspect it. So the vendor always knows what we're doing.
So with these appliance vendors and stuff, and I imagine that's for sort of smaller plays where the banks can sort of force their supplier to do that, right? Because I know some guys in financial services and that's how it works. But I can't imagine Cisco allowing their stuff to be scanned, you know, just because some bank wants to buy their stuff and that's part of their procurement procedure. So, you had something to say there?
No, you're absolutely right. The law, if you look at sort of the top 10 hardware manufacturers or the top 10 software manufacturers, they just say, no, we're not going to allow that.
Yeah.
But the smaller vendors kind of have to, because that keeps them in business.
But the question is, do the larger vendors actually sign up for these sorts of scans? Because, you know, it seems every other week Cisco is patching a static password, like, a hard-coded password in their appliances. Like, are vendors actually starting to go and say, here's our source, or even here's a binary, please scan and see if there's any backdoors, just as part of the QA process? Is that common?
We're starting to see it. When the Juniper backdoor got exposed, and obviously it was extremely widely publicized.
So this has been good for business, basically.
Yeah. We started to hear from some of their competitors and some other appliance makers, and they said, I don't want this to happen to me. I want to find it before someone else finds it. So Juniper has been good for business.
Yeah, right. Now, when it comes to the crypto bug, though, because this was just using different parameters as part of the dual EC whatever, right? So this was a very subtle thing, very difficult to spot. I mean, by doing static analysis, is this something that you're going to be able to spot? Because I wouldn't have thought so.
No, there's something like a crypto backdoor. It really requires human inspection. Someone has to be able to understand how the crypto algorithm is supposed to work and understand magic constants are critical, and to be able to check if those magic constants are within the range that they need to be, you know, check for randomness and things like that. So those are, you know, crypto bugs are pretty subtle. What you could do with static analysis, and we don't do this specifically, but I can imagine, you know, someone building a tool to this, is really narrow the scope of what needed to be inspected by hand and understand where the data flows are, where the edges of the crypto routines are, so you can kind of focus your manual review to one small piece of the code.
So look, it's nice to know that vendors are coming to the party, but you know, what can a typical CISO do when it comes to looking for this sort of stuff in their environment? Should they just sort of insist upon, you know, at least some sort of report from some sort of static analysis firm like you? I mean, you guys aren't the only firm that does this sort of thing. Should they ask for some sort of tick where they can? I mean, should this be part of the procurement procedure?
You know, absolutely. You know, we expect people to back up their statements with, an actual testing, right? So like, you wouldn't think a car was safe if they weren't actually crash testing it, right? If the designers designed it and they built it and they never crash test it, would you think that they had a safe design unless they actually tested to see if the crash test dummy, you know, had too much acceleration and would have died, right? So you have to ask the vendor, you know, have you reviewed for backdoors? Have you audited your code for backdoors? You know, use the Juniper example, the Fortinet example, and say, you know, even customer support or debugging backdoors, I don't care what you called it. Have you audited your code and do you have those? And if they say yes, you say, you know, was it a third party? When was it done? Will you sign this to say that you've done this? And then even better, say, you know, what's your process going forward? Do you do these kinds of reviews on an annual basis, on a quarterly basis? And make them, you know, make statements about if they're actually checking for this stuff instead of just saying, you know, trust me, I got it covered.
Now, look, you know, you guys have scanned an awful lot of software. As you say, the company's been around for like 10 years now, right? So, you know, is this the sort of thing that turns up a lot in scans?
I wouldn't say it turns up a lot, but it does. It does turn up. And I don't know of a case where it's turned up and it was malicious. Whenever it turns up, it always seems to be, that's a customer support functionality, or that's, oops, we left in the debug code. But that also could be someone, you know, CYA, not letting us know that their source code is out of their control. But also just, you know, the ones that I've been exposed to, by looking at them, they really look like a missed feature that some developers thought was a good idea, and they didn't understand the security risk of that debug code or that support code.
Yeah, except in the Juniper example, it doesn't really look like that was what happened, even by their own statement.
No, that's true, and I have to hand it to them by not trying to spin it and saying that this was a super smart obfuscated support backdoor that they really didn't know about it.
It's my feeling, Chris, that it was the SEC guidance that was released a few years ago, which is the reason that they actually had to come clean on that, because they would have got an awful spanking if the truth had to come out later.
That's true. So, you know, that's why I'm all for these SEC guidelines, these disclosure, because if you force people to make statements about what they've done for security, they have to be truthful, because if it comes out that they're not truthful, there's a huge amount of liability. So just forcing people to make statements and disclose and be transparent about what they're doing for security is an important function of, you know, regulating, public companies like with the SEC. Mm.
Yeah. Right, Chris, that's actually all we're going to have time for, but thank you very much for joining us on the program, and I hope we get to chat to you again in 2016.
Thanks, Patrick. It was great talking with you.
Chris Weisopel, CTO of Veracode there. Big thanks to him. Okay, we're going to check in with Martin Hroten now. Martin is the editor of Virus Bulletin. I was curious to get his thoughts on how the AV community is dealing with recent vulnerability disclosures in AV suites. Tavis Ormandy, who is of Google's Project Zero, he's gone a bit berserk lately, dropping bugs in Trend and AVG. I think last year he dropped some bugs in Kaspersky, Sophos before that. And all of these bugs have one thing in common, which is that they're comedy bugs. They're really hysterically bad bugs that just shouldn't be there. Now, some criticism of AV products can be a bit silly. Martin says. He recalled to me one time where a researcher was screaming about bad encryption on signatures in an AV product, when really the only reason the vendor encrypted them at all was to obfuscate them so they wouldn't trip IDSs on their way through the gateway, which seems like a, you know, sensible enough reason just to deploy some crappy crypto. But despite quibbles with some of the statements made about AV by some researchers, Martin says the AV industry is starting to realize product security is a real issue it has to deal with. And he says Tavis's constant disclosures are starting to bite.
I think there's definitely an impact. I don't speak for a vendor. That makes it very easy, because he's not targeting my product or my baby or whatever. But the reaction to people like Tavis is, it's a bit mixed. I mean, no one likes their own product being made fun of. No one likes someone pointing out vulnerabilities. People like Tavis, they can be a bit of a troll on Twitter. I mean, you know, they exaggerate the threat. At the same time, everyone agrees. Everyone I've spoken to agrees that this is an issue. And we've actually seen several AV vendors set up bug bounty programs. I've spoken to others who said they're discussing it or thinking it's a good idea. So I think what Tav is doing is very important and should be appreciated, and is appreciated by quite a few people in the traditional AV sphere.
Now, look, I've known a lot of people who do vulnerability research for a long time, and you know they've long known that AV software is very insecure because you know they have to parse everything, right? So we've known this for a long time, and yet we don't seem to be seeing attackers actually using bugs in AV software, or are we? Is this something that you've heard of? I'm curious.
I've not really heard of. I mean, there's one or two very targeted cases, but we've not seen massive like the opportunistic malware that targets millions of computers at the same time. We've not really seen it abuse AV. And I think one of the reasons is that there's so many different kinds of AV software out there. Mm. And there's not one. If you have a worm against product X, that it would just stop because your neighbor uses product Y and their neighbor uses product Z.
Well, I do lie, in fact, because I do remember one, but it was a long time ago. I don't know if you remember the worm against Black Ice, which was, I think, by then owned by ISS. Someone went a little bit berserk and wrote a really nasty worm for that stuff.
Is that the one that Rob Graham programmed? I think it was his bug that was exploited.
Yeah, well, it was his software, actually, that was exploited.
Yes, his software, yeah. He had introduced the bug or something, yeah. That's true, and that is actually the only known only case that I really know. And that's probably also one reason why AV hasn't really addressed this issue previously, because no one is attacking it. I mean, now Tavis is, and that's great, but no one is attacking. Perhaps from a marketing or management point of view, why would you do something about an issue that's not really a practical issue?
Yeah.
I'm not defending, just explaining how this works.
So are you predicting we're going to see more bug bounties in the sort of among AV makers? Do you think that's going to turn into a trend? I mean, that would be good news, I'd imagine.
I think it's likely going to happen. I think at some point this will make the news, and you have to. I think until now, marketing probably could have told you, well, no one's really attacking it. So bug bounty is a way of admitting that our software it's not perfect, so just don't do it. But you probably can't do it for very much longer anymore. So,
do you think that's partially goes some way to explaining why Tavis does inject a little bit of ridicule into his advisories? Do you think it's almost required to get these guys to get off their ass, like so that the marketing managers are like, okay, they're laughing at us now. We need to do something about it.
Perhaps, maybe. If that's the case, then it's a good thing. I personally appreciate what Davis and others are doing.
Martin Roten there. Big thanks to him for that. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Haroon Mir of Thinkst Applied Research. Haroon is a very well-respected authority in information security, and Thinkst is a very interesting company in information security. They run the Fish5 service that you can use to run spear phishing campaigns against your users. It's notable because it is so much cheaper than competing services. It's ridiculously affordable. So if this is something that you're thinking of doing, do check out Fish5. That's PHISH5, the number 5. Thinkst also publishes subscription-based research like Thinkstscapes. That's a mouthful. Thinkstscapes. Try saying that 5 times very quickly. But it's a product they launched 8 months ago that's going absolutely berserk. It's called Canary Tools, and you would have heard about it on this show before. Basically, Haroon's canaries, as he calls them, they're tiny little embedded honeypots that you plug into your network. You can set them up in about 2 minutes, and they'll alert you when someone is doing naughty things on your LAN, which is usually a fairly high-quality indicator that something has gone majorly pear-shaped. Well, Thinkst has done some more development work in honeypot-related stuff, sort of, and they're giving it away for free. Canary Tokens, canarytokens.org, is a website they've put together that lets you generate alert tokens like URLs or domains that when they're hit or queried, they generate alerts. So you email around a dodgy link to some super sensitive HR or credit card data, you know, a fake link to something like that. Someone clicks it and boom, you get an alert. Now, Thinkst has also made all of the code that makes this stuff work available. You can see the source, or you can just get a Docker container so you can install your own instance and use your own domains and stuff. It is great stuff, and it's free stuff for you. Haroon Mir, join me via Skype to explain what Canary Tokens are.
Okay, so Canary Tokens are a throwback to, a super old concept, which people used to talk about honey tokens in the past. Essentially, they're little pieces of data that you can throw around your servers or your desktops or whatever. And the hope is that those little pieces of data become good flags of badness when bad things are happening. So there's a bunch of different ways you can detect it. In the oldest forms, people were saying, listen, put this record in your database and then have your IDS look out for this record. And if this record ever went across the wire, you know you've been popped because it shouldn't show up in normal database queries.
Yeah, this stuff was really hip in like the early 2000s.
Yeah, what's interesting is we looked at a bunch of those things and lots of people were talking about it. Like lots of people, consultants speak about it, except nobody's really doing it. And you'll find a bunch of reasons why they're not. One of them is because everybody's got fires that they need to chase. But some of them are just harder than people seem to think they are. And so what we've done, and this is kind of a big part of our new gig, is trying to make stuff that people have spoken about easy enough for regular folks to use. And this is kind of why we make Canary tools happen, or Canary tokens happen.
So why don't you walk us through exactly what it is? Because basically what you do is you enter your email address for alerts, and then you generate one of these tokens, and then you sort of scatter it around. So these tokens can be things like URLs that if anyone ever clicks on them, that will generate an alert, right?
Yeah. So if you hit the site, what you're going to do is you're going to get a spot that says enter your email address and then enter a comment. And both of those things are not because we want them. Both are necessary for you to get your alert. So essentially, you put in your Patrick email address and you put a comment saying, I want to test Dropbox. And essentially, if you hit generate token at that point, what you're going to get there is a bunch of tokens being created. Okay, so if you go down, you're going to see there's a web bug created and a DNS token created. So if you take it at its simplest, it's going to throw you a URL. So if you take that URL, which is now unique, and store it in your Dropbox folder somewhere, the day that you get popped, someone comes across that URL, someone surfs that URL, essentially what's going to happen is they're going to surf the URL, they get back a one-by-one transparent GIF, and on our end, we'll email the email address with the comment. So we're going to send an email to the email you entered with the comment that you entered. So you're going to get an alert suddenly that says, testing Dropbox token.
Okay, so, I mean, this makes sense, right? Because you can seed it somewhere and you can say, you know, dress it up like a cut and pasted email saying, oh, here's access to our HR data. You know, I didn't bother encrypting it. I'll pull it offline eventually, right? You leave that URL. Of course, someone's going to click it to see if it's there. One thing that I worry about, though, is, you know, these days with modern operating systems and even cloud services, don't you have a problem with crawlers and indexing daemons going through and like visiting these URLs?
Yeah, it's an interesting. So nothing's going to index those links for us because they don't exist as links. They're just programmatically generated. And if
well, they exist once they're generated and stored somewhere. Like if I store that on my computer, eventually, like something's going to come past and see it, right?
Well, if something on your computer sees it, you're going to know. So for example, if you take that URL and decide to throw it in Slack or in HipChat or something like that, yeah, sure, twice a day you're going to find that Slack or HipChat while archiving your stuff is going to hit your token. And for some, that alone is an eye-opener. But what you're really worried about is 3 weeks from now when it goes off at 2 in the morning and it turns out that an HipChat admin is now browsing URLs from your folder. So yeah, you're going to worry about that. But so the one thing is, like you say, you put it in a URL saying, here's your HR stuff. But for example, if you were using Gmail, right, just pin it in your first email, a thing that says, here's the goods from you to Adam. And the next time your Gmail gets owned, the guy reading your inbox is going to browse mail number one. He's going to bump into it. And of course, if you go down the list, you'll see from that one token, we give you a bunch of different ways to access it. So the one way would be if you actually surf to it. The other would be simply doing a NS lookup on it, so just resolving a certain domain name. Okay, and you can see that there's a bunch of places where we can use that. So if the guy literally just resolves a certain DNS name, that's going to now fire a token that says, look, something's happened.
Someone's looking up a domain name that doesn't exist that was set up precisely to tell us when something bad has happened.
Exactly. But what actually happens, the cooler thing, is that once you've got this primitive that says when a hostname lookup happens, do something, it now allows you to do a bunch of helper scripts. So for example, you'll notice way down, we've got an option called Windows Directory Browsing. where if you put a INI file in your Windows folder and then assign an icon to that INI file, essentially when anyone tries to browse that folder, they're going to try to do a host resolution to resolve that icon file. So now what you can do is have a folder on your machine, and anytime anyone browses to that folder, it's going to trigger your token. And the reason this is possible is because behind the scenes, it's doing a DNS lookup, and we're now triggering on that DNS lookup.
Yeah, so Microsoft enables people to embed like image data from elsewhere or whatever in icon files.
Exactly. And yeah. And you can now take those two primitives and use them in a bunch of places, right? So for example, on SQL Server, we can now create fake views or fake triggers that say when someone's in here and they're accessing this data, do this DNS lookup. And essentially that now inadvertently triggers your token. If you start looking at embedded stuff in documents, so in MS Word or in PDF or stuff like that, you can now start embedding little these tokens. And the cool thing about it for us is all of these things, and again, you should see a common theme with some of the other stuff that we're doing, is all of it should be easy to do, fire and forget. So you take these tokens, sprinkle them in as many places as you want to, and literally forget about them. And if they never call you back, you don't care. And if they do, you now know you've got to go check up and see what's up. And you can take them to a bunch of places. So we've also got, we did this as part of our Vegas talk last year, a Black Hat Vegas talk. And we've also got a bunch of helper scripts. So on OS X, we've got a script so that you can watch certain commands, for example. So you can say, if anyone ever runs ifconfig on this machine, trigger this token. And so you end up with a whole bunch of tiny helper scripts that you can run that basically should be able to set up in 5 minutes and tell you when you've got bad stuff going down.
Yeah, no, it's a great idea. Thinking of the Microsoft Office, callback tokens or whatever. I mean, people have been doing this, custom-wise for quite a long time. What I find hilarious is it turns out even APT crews will happily open Word documents from unfirewalled boxes and just be spraying out beacons left and right. They don't care. It's just, it's embarrassing. I feel embarrassed by some of these attackers. They're supposed to be better than that.
I think for the most part, they're good enough. And the fact that they suck is probably a reflection on how much we suck right now.
Yeah, right.
Like they don't need to suck any less because we're not doing any better.
Now, of course, I before we actually hit record on this interview, I was like, well, hang on, with these URLs and these custom domains and stuff, like surely if it's just coming off the one URL, which is like canarytokens.com, that's going to be pretty easy for attackers to spot. So, are you adding more domain names and whatever? And you said you've made the whole thing available as a Docker image.
Yeah, so the whole thing's completely free, so guys can download the Docker images. And in fact, the Docker image has something else, so you can hook it up to Twilio and get SMSs instead of just email notices. But the whole thing, if I'm not mistaken, we've BSD licensed it, so guys can take it and do what they want with it. Like, we don't care. And we've already seen people doing some pretty cool stuff. So we've seen some guys literally tying it to document creation in the enterprise. So every doc that's created through their DRM stuff actually gets tokens embedded in them. There's coolness. And again, the whole point is just that it's quick, it's simple. Why wouldn't you do it? So the other cool thing on this, which is just the last thing that we've added, and again, it's because you've got these building blocks, is, for example, you can take your website, and you find that most websites right before a phishing attack are typically cloned by someone or the other. And so, for example, you can now insert a little bit of JavaScript into your website that says, look, if this website ever runs on a URL, that's not our company domain.com. Fire this token. And so again, all we do is when you're generating your token, you click on the little button that says cloned site. And if anyone ever happens to view your site on another server, your token gets fired. You get an email alert telling you that this has happened.
Now, this would be useful for organizations that develop web code, right? To see if someone's ripping it off.
Yeah, well, it's useful for that. And it's useful in general. Like if you've got a Microsoft Outlook web access exchange open to the internet, literally take this JS that the site creates for you, throw it into your OWA, and the next time someone actually dupes your site, you're going to get a message saying, listen, your site's now been cloned and is now running on this other infrastructure.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It costs you nothing. It's 2 minutes of your time, and you're better off for knowing it.
Now, what I really like about all of this is you've taken ideas that were around 15 years ago and you've actually made them practical. Now, you know, we're talking about your free stuff, but of course there's Canary Tools, which is the commercial stuff that you guys are doing, which I think, you know, you were on this show talking about that very shortly after you launched. I think, what was it, about a year ago?
Yeah, about 8 months ago, yeah.
Yeah, and I understand that's doing really well. Like, my favorite anecdote that you've told me is you saw one customer bought 5 of them, of these little honeypots. If people don't know, they should check out Canary Tools because it's really good stuff. A customer bought 5 of them. It tripped an alert, which is a really high quality alert, basically saying they'd been owned. And then there was an email that came in from the same customer about 5 minutes later saying, yes, we would like to buy more of these, please.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. So we don't actually see their consoles, but we do see email metadata as it passes. And so it is kind of funny because you see the alert go through and a few minutes later you see, we'd like to buy more Canaries. Now, so far they've been doing really well. So at this point they installed just about all over the world, literally from Iceland to Australia. Dark Africa has a whole ton of them. A bunch of them up in the States. And so far, what makes us happy is lots of customers who've tried them out initially. And again, the way we've built the service is that it's really cheap to get going. So literally, for someone can start for under 10K and they get like 5 birds. Our whole promise with the system is that 4 minutes after you get your box, you should be up and running with a high-quality honeypot. And so essentially for us, it becomes, listen, man, for $5,000 and 5 minutes of your time, you are not going to do anything better during your lunch break today.
Yeah, well,
like literally take 5 minutes.
It's a pretty compelling pitch. It is. It's a pretty compelling pitch. But I'm just wondering, like, you know, this stuff, the Canaries, of course, they're external little honeypots that you plug in, you just drop and go. You know, these tokens are more about seeding data, like honeypot style data, honey data, around your existing infrastructure. And that's free stuff. It's a little bit more fiddly, right? Which is probably why it's free.
Yep.
Are you looking at any sort of projects around integrating both of these approaches? So you've got your external honeypots, which is Canary Tools, and then you're going to have your Canary tokens, and like you can have some sort of master, you know, honey console?
Yeah, it's absolutely on the card. So it's stuff that we're already working on. So in fact, right now with your Canary honeypots, there's a point where you can add documents to a fake SMB server. And for example, in development right now, we've got it so that the documents that you drop are actually seeded with honey tokens also. So those then call back to the console. So it's going to take a little longer because mainly the work that we put in is removing the fiddliness, and removing the fiddliness, like there's always new ways to fiddle. But the whole point is absolutely for it to be on the roadmap so that the two converge at some point.
You better be careful, Haroon. You're going to turn into a vendor and then you're going to have to get capped teeth. Do you know what I mean? You're going to have to wear power suits. You got to be careful, mate, because this could happen.
I fear this. I'm watching out for it, and I give you full permission to shoot me if you see anything like this happening.
All right. I just keep picturing you with giant teeth, you know, Tony Robbins teeth, and it's a little bit disturbing. Haroon, that's actually all we got time for, mate, but thank you so much for joining us on the show. Thanks a lot for sponsoring the show as well. It's great to talk about, you know, these Canary tokens and stuff, and I really hope some listeners out there can go and play with them and, you know, maybe even get back to me. Let me know, you know, what the experience was like, or get in touch with Haroon. Let him know. But Haroon Mir, thank you very much for joining us, and we will chat to you again throughout the year.
Thanks, Patrick. Chat soon.
That was Haroon Mir of ThinksFair. Huge thanks to him for that. I'm a big believer in what these guys are doing, and I really think that, you know, spending a bit of time looking into this stuff would not be a waste of your time. Let's just say that. So you can check out the commercial stuff at canary.tools, or you can check out their free stuff at canarytokens.org. Both of those things worth checking out. And with that is it for this week's show. I'll be back next week with more information security news and features. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.